Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of KleptoCast, the podcast series from the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. My name is Casey Michelle, and my guest today is Jack Blum, a renowned Washington lawyer who is an expert on financial crime and international tax evasion. Mr. Blum spent years working as a staff attorney with both the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's also worked extensively on asset recovery with the United Nations. Mr. Blum, it's an honor to have you with us today. Just as a first question, can you talk a bit about what asset recovery in and of itself encompasses and how asset recovery became another tool to fight against modern kleptocracy?
Asset recovery is the recovery of money that's been taken by government officials, typically a senior government official, from a country. And that money has suddenly disappeared. And now the question is, can the money be recovered by the country to be used for public purposes? Now, the main reason for being concerned about asset recovery, in addition to simply getting back money that was stolen, is the notion of deterrence. What we want to have happen more than anything else is the next head of state or the next family that gets control of government and uses it to steal will in fact be afraid that somewhere along the line that money will be taken away from them, and they simply won't be able to leave the country and enjoy what they've stolen.
From your perspective and given your background, are there any prominent cases that stand out to you or maybe that you've worked on that encapsulate this the phenomenon of asset recovery as a tool against kleptocracy?
The case that I was involved in, albeit somewhat peripherally, was the case of Sonny Abacha in Nigeria. And Abacha was said to have stolen somewhere around $6 billion from the Nigerian government coffers. In fact, on several occasions, he simply picked up the phone and said to the Nigerian central bank, give me money. And the money was transferred to him. When he died and lost control of the government, the succeeding government said, let's see what we can do to recover the money. They went about asking for help through various mutual legal assistance treaties and through private legal actions in different countries to see what they could get back out of the monies that had been stolen. Roughly $1 billion, maybe a little more than $1 billion, I can't say precisely, has come back to Nigeria out of the money that was taken. It was a very long and tortured process to get that money back into the hands of the Nigerian government. The biggest help in this recovery effort turned out in the end to be the government of Switzerland, which froze the Abacha assets and then found a way to give them back to Nigeria. That was very helpful indeed, and cut through a lot of red tape. But I can say that there were so many problems associated with this bit of asset recovery that it's a miracle that any money got back at all.
And in terms of the issues involved with Mr. Abacha's case, again, Sonny Abacha was once listed as one of Transparency International's top 10 global kleptocrats. He is certainly not any kind of small-scale individual. Just in terms of the issues that you encountered working on the Sonny Abacha case, Mr. Blum, what are some of the issues that come to mind or that really stood out to you as something that future instances of asset recovery need to deal with in order to be successful?
Serious problem, and it's a problem that cuts across all sorts of international criminal activity, and for that matter, criminal activity that's national. It's not just international. It's the anonymous corporation. It's the ability to take assets and put it in the hands of a corporation that's set up in some secrecy jurisdiction, mm-hmm. and then move that money around in a way that disguises where it came from, mm-hmm. and then make it available at the end to the people who've stolen it. Mm-hmm. That goes on a lot, and the biggest single thing that can be done to change it is to eliminate the anonymous corporation,
right.
and to bar anonymous corporations from secrecy jurisdictions from having bank accounts anywhere in the real world in real money.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to be something that's beyond the capacity of the international community to do.
Mm-hmm. As I'm sure many of our listeners are aware, the U.S. has become something of fertile ground for those looking to set up these anonymous shell companies in states like Nevada, Delaware, and Wyoming. And I was wondering, Mr. Blum, given your lengthy track record as it pertains to asset recovery, is this a relatively new phenomenon in terms of using anonymous shell companies to move such substantial funds, or is this something that we have seen continue apace over the past few decades as it pertains to grand corruption instances like Mr. Abacha?
This has been going on for at least 45 to 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the year 1999, I was a co-author of a report on offshore secrecy jurisdictions,
right.
That was published by the United Nations. And that report laid out the use of offshore secrecy jurisdictions and anonymous corporations to undermine tax collection and to help people who were kleptocrats.
Mm-hmm.
That led to various conferences sponsored by the UN where this issue was discussed.
Right.
And a lot of people, a lot of the member states and delegates all said, oh, this is terrible. We've got to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, it wound up being a lot of hot air and not much more.
Right.
Because so many of these places make so much money out of the business of incorporation,
mm-hmm.
and actually have industries that turn on effectively keeping things secret and having these anonymous corporations act as a buffer,
yeah.
between criminals and the banking system.
Mm-hmm. Just as it pertains to asset recovery, I was wondering if I might be able to ask about the Kleptocracy Asset Recovery Initiative, which was formed in the U.S. in 2010 by the Department of Justice. It's a program tasked with helping the U.S. return ill-gotten assets to jurisdictions elsewhere. For listeners who aren't familiar, they've already worked on cases involving kleptocracies in places like Malaysia, Uzbekistan, and Equatorial Guinea. So, Mr. Blum, we're 7 years into that program. From your vantage, from your perspective, what's your take on the Kleptocracy Asset Recovery Initiative? Is it something worth expanding moving forward?
Well, the initiative will tell everybody involved how serious the problems are when you actually try to get your hands on the assets,
mm-hmm.
and use the judicial system to make it happen. To give you an idea of the kinds of problems that people confront, start out with the problem of whose money is it?
Right.
So we can all say that the mansion in Malibu that was purchased by the son of the head of Equatorial Guinea, Mr. Obiang,
mm-hmm.
Was money that was stolen because the son was earning the equivalent of, I think it was $30,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
The mansion was $25, $30 million. But the mansion was not owned directly.
Right.
He had a collection of sports cars. The sports cars were in the name of offshore companies. And then there was the question of a jet, a private jet,
mm-hmm.
which was owned through, again, anonymous offshore companies.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came to actually getting any of this money, which was so obviously stolen, the first problem was, how can you prove that the offshore corporation is connected to the person who's the kleptocrat?
Right.
The second problem was, how do you prove that the money was the proceeds of a crime, which is what you have to do to take money away from someone. You can't just simply say, oh, yeah, you're a government official of a government that have this kind of money floating around. It must be that you stole it. Therefore, we're going to take anything you have away from you.
Right.
The courts want to see more than that. And they want to know, was this money, in fact, stolen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the difficulty there is really a tough one.
Okay.
You can't bring a foreign head of state into the United States and put him on trial for a crime. And the reasons for it are pretty obvious. The foreign head of state or the family of the foreign head of state will absolutely not be willing to defend themselves in a foreign jurisdiction against crimes that are alleged in their own country.
Mm-hmm.
And getting the conviction, which creates what is called in the business the predicate offense, is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it really depends on how the judge rules on some of the evidence that's put forward. It depends on what happens in the course of the trial, how much can be said and done to prove the ownership of the money and the illegitimacy of the money.
Right.
This is tough stuff legally.
Right.
But it's really worth the effort for the simple reason that the case will demonstrate to anybody who's watching exactly what the problems are and exactly what we have to do to fix the system.
I was going to ask, due to the litany of issues that still remain in terms of actually obtaining the assets forfeited and then returning those to the jurisdictions in question, as I'm sure you're aware, Mr. Blum, some analysts have said that asset recovery is something of a misallocation of resources and that these resources could be better spent on other areas of prevention and deterrence. Is there any merit to those arguments, or do you believe that...
I would argue not.
Okay.
I think the most important thing that can be done is go after the money for the simple reason that the message has to go to the successor of the person who stole it, that, gee, your job is not to steal as much as you can, because if you do, you're going to wind up spending the rest of your life in court trying to protect what you've stolen.
Right.
And it's a way of saying or sending a message to people who would be kleptocrats that crime doesn't pay.
Right.
Unless we do that, we'll see each person who comes to power saying, hey, now it's my turn. And that's happened again and again and again, particularly in developing countries. In Africa, it's been particularly spectacular, but Latin America hasn't been exempt from the problem either.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that has to be pursued. We can't simply let people buy their $1 million worth of sports cars and houses in Paris and expect that they'll be able to enjoy it all, even though it's obvious that the money's been stolen.
And just as a final question to him, Mr. Blum, where would you like to see either the Kleptocracy Asset Recovery Initiative here in the U.S. or even the global efforts at asset recovery? Where would you like to see it go moving forward? How can it be strengthened? How should it be expanded from your vantage?
Well, the way I look at it is that the best way to go forward is to take it out of the business of the criminal system, and rather do the recovery using civil rather than criminal courts.
Right.
What I've thought is that the best way of moving forward was to make the effort one of civil recovery as opposed to basing it on criminal conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Because to convict someone of a crime, you need a much higher standard of proof.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're in that realm of having to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt, it becomes very difficult to cut through what happens in court to the point where you're actually going to recover money.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you an example of how crazy it can get. Some of Abacha's money was in Liechtenstein. The government of Liechtenstein cheerfully froze some of the money that could be identified. But then the question came, could the money be repatriated? Well, the government of Liechtenstein brilliantly said, you will have to come to our country and prove the criminal conviction of the people who own this money before we can get it back. Mm-hmm. The answer to them was, look, this is idiocy because Abacha's dead. Yeah. And under common law, when a person dies, that's the end. There's no more criminal charge. Mm-hmm. So he was never convicted of stealing. So on the circus went years and years of litigation to try to pry that money loose and get it back to the people of Nigeria. And that's gone on for the better part of 15 years or more. So civil made the most sense. Okay. What also is a problem, and it's a huge problem, is who should actually be doing the recovery? Who has the burden of doing it? Typically, the country that's been ripped off doesn't have the resources to do it.
Right.
And the question of who's going to spend the kind of money involved in a recovery effort is a really difficult problem. Because it can involve hiring lawyers in maybe 10 or 15 jurisdictions to cut through the tangle of anonymous corporations, property transfers, and bank accounts. And somebody's got to pay for all of that, pay for the travel, pay for the forensic work, the examination. And that is a huge problem we have to solve, and it can't be done based on a single country's efforts. Mm-hmm. It really has to be through some sort of international agreement. And there, what I think should happen is we should be putting together perhaps a global law firm, mm-hmm. if you will, that has a mandate from a country that's been ripped off to recover the money. The idea would be to have the proceeds assigned to this recovery effort. And then let the lawyers go to work on it wherever they have to around the world. Mm-hmm. And because they're operating civilly, they won't be constrained and it won't have to be a governmental effort. But this is a very difficult problem. And the more you know about it, the more difficult it is. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. And it doesn't mean that the efforts of the Justice Department are a waste of time. They're not.